Mormon Stories podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Edward Kimball, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to have the opportunity to interview you. I've been wanting to interview you for a long time, ever since Dan Witherspoon told me about your book. I think I'm going to go ahead and hold up your book for our audience. The book is called Lengthen Your Stride, The Presidency of Spencer W. Kimball. I remember hearing about this several years ago, and really, really enjoying and appreciating what you did. But this is a biography. It's your second biography on Spencer W. Kimball, is that right?
The first was published in 1977, and it covered his life up to that point. This covers all of the presidency years from 1973 to 1985, 12 years.
And I guess it should be stated that you are the son of Spencer W. Kimball.
Yes, I'm the youngest of four children.
Youngest of four. Well, let's talk about your life and your reflections and impressions, if that's okay.
Sure.
Maybe let's start a little bit about your father. What can you tell us about just a quick 5-minute version of his upbringing, and maybe what type of background led to him being prepared to become prophet for the church?
He was born in 1898 in Salt Lake City, Utah. And when he was 3 years old, his father was called to be stake president in Arizona. Uprooted his family, moved there like a mission calling, but he was there the rest of his life until 1923. 25 years he had spent mostly in Arizona. And my father went to school there and married there and went into business there, established an insurance and real estate agency. And in 1936, he was called to be the stake president over the area where his father had been stake president.
What part of Arizona again?
This is in the Gila Valley.
Okay.
There's a new temple being built in the town near, adjacent to the town of Thatcher, which is where he lived for his early years, and within a couple of miles of the place where we lived until 1943, when he was called to be a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. His life was that, really, of a small-town businessman who was active in the church. He was acquainted with other general authorities. His father had been a friend of Heber J. Grant when they were boys, and he was a grandson of Heber C. Kimball, as was, well, J. Golden Kimball was a son of Heber C. Kimball, so that was his uncle. So that he was not an anonymous person. He was somebody who was known, so that when they called him to be a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, they were not dealing with a stranger. He had, among other things, been instrumental in dealing with a flood in Duncan, Arizona, on the Gila River, that sort of brought attention to him because he had successfully managed the welfare effort to try to rehabilitate the town that had been severely damaged by flooding. And he had recruited church members to help bring back the town and what was a suffering community. So in 1943, he was received a telephone call from Salt Lake City asking for Spencer Kimball, and I was answering the phone as a little boy, and said, "Here he comes now," or something like that. He had come home for lunch, and he received the phone call, slumped down to the floor, unbelieving about that what he had been asked. He was told by J. Reuben Clark, who also was his cousin, was told that the Quorum of the Twelve and the presidency had decided to call him. So the family moved to Utah, and he pursued his life and assignment as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve for 30-odd years, till 1974, when President Lee died. He, as the senior apostle, became president of the church.
Do you get a sense that in his formative years, even as an adult, as a father, that he exhibited unique or remarkable traits of integrity or of strength or of faith? Is there a sense that he was just one of many who could be called, or that maybe there was something special about him that really did set him apart?
It's a little hard for me to answer. He was a people person. If there was a party, people would be gathered around him having a conversation. If they were going to be singing, he would go to the piano and play to accompany the singing. I remember being told by a child of a stake president. In those earlier days, people often had guest books where they would have people who came to their home sign a guest register. And in this one case, there was a place for entry, hobbies. And this was Spencer W. Kimball. Hobby was, "I love people." Mm. And she said that many years later, he came back to the same home and wrote the same hobby. Mm. But he really was a loving person, and I think a very accepting person. He loved his family, and we certainly loved him. He was a soft parent. I didn't get scolded by him very often. It's because I was such a good kid, maybe. But he was affectionate physically. When we met, we kissed. So those are things that may not seem very important, and yet a personality that is full of love is, to the degree that he did, is really a little bit unusual. He was energetic. He was athletic. He was a voracious reader. He didn't read fiction, but he read a lot. He was self-educated in that sense, because he had only one semester of college before he was called up for military service and married. Another characteristic, as I think back, is that he was willing to do things that were unusual. Someone told me that when he was state clerk, this is as a young man, that he, for state conference, created a big chart that showed statistics in the stake. I mean, so this was not something that was required. It was just something extra that he did. And throughout his life, he was willing to tackle new things, different things. He was not afraid of change.
And you were born in Arizona?
I was born in Arizona in 1930. So I'll soon be 80 years old. And I was 12 years old when we moved to Salt Lake, when he was called as a member of the Quorum. And I remember it was a very distressing situation. I thought that I was much imposed upon to have to leave my childhood home and go to the big city. But we got along.
What's it like to have your dad called as prophet or apostle? Let's start with apostle.
Well, as I say, I was devastated. I thought that was a terrible thing to have happen to our family.
Really? When the news came, you were devastated because you had to move?
Because we had to move.
You just had friends and loved Arizona.
That's right. I had never lived anywhere else. A small town, you get pretty well integrated. The town of Safford, where we lived, in the Gila Valley, just a couple of miles from Thatcher, where he had grown up. The town's about 2,000 people nowadays, maybe a little bigger now, but it's a county seat. It had a main street, and you could look down Main Street to the courthouse, and often happened there was nobody between you and the courthouse down the end of the street.
So what'd you love about it? Just friends and...
Just friends, school. Yeah.
But what about, I imagine you were a faithful, believing member. You know that there's a prophet in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and now your dad's becoming one. Certainly that would be remarkable or fascinating or spiritually validating or...
It may seem like it should be, but I didn't think that big, that broadly. You said I was a member of the church, but I grew up in the church and it all seemed pretty natural.
Like when, you know, didn't you want to like see the general authorities and see the prophet and...
Not that I can recall.
The Mormon Tabernacle Choir and...
No, I'm afraid not.
Huh.
No. And I suppose maybe people assume that a person who is good enough and qualified enough to be a general authority is somehow a different sort of person than their neighbors and friends. But my experience has been that in any ward I have ever lived in, there are people who have the same good qualities, that have the faithfulness and are devoted and believing, and they just happen not to have been called. Hmm. So he was called. It was his turn to take on that responsibility. And it seemed sort of natural, not remarkable.
This is a bit of a slightly sensitive topic, maybe not for you, but you walk with some... Crutches, is that?
Crutches, yeah.
Tell us about...
When just as I was turning 3 years of age, I was stricken with polio, poliomyelitis. And I was hospitalized in California. My parents didn't know what it was at first. The doctor had no other cases. It was not an epidemic at the time, but just suddenly, out of the blue, they have a child who... was paralyzed partially. And I had a series of operations on my legs to make it possible for me to walk. The necessity for crutches is largely an old age characteristic. I walked without crutches most of my life, though awkwardly, I walked. The crutches are necessary now. I can't walk without them. But I don't think it's affected me very much in my life.
You've done okay?
I've done okay.
Do you know if it was ever a struggle of faith for the family, wanting this not to be, or trying to...
Within polio?
Yeah, like, do you have a sense that your parents tried to...
No, I remember, there is, in early documents of my life, there's a note that they asked Elder Callis, Charles A. Callis, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, who was visiting the stake in Arizona, to give me a blessing in which he blessed me that I would recover fully, which didn't happen. And my mother reported that she had friends who said, why did this have to happen to you? You're such a good person. And her response was, it happened to me because I got a germ. I mean, she was not equating this difficulty and disability of her son with some sort of sinful conduct or deserts of a...
And never a frustration that God wouldn't answer the prayer or heal?
No, some people thought that it might be either a cause of discomfort. I've never thought of it as anything except what happened.
Right.
Not connected with faithfulness or not.
And never cursing God or questioning God for...
Not on that account, no.
Tell us about your mother.
My mother, Camilla Eyring, of good heritage. Her name is better known now than other. Elder or President Eyring is my first cousin. So that, and his father was Henry Eyring, a noted scientist. Well, my mother was the oldest child of the family, and Henry Eyring attributed a lot of the incentives that he had to get a good education to on the fact that his older sister was much often encouraging him to increase his educational opportunities. This is coming out of a little town of Pima, Arizona, which is not much more than a crossroads.
So Camilla, I'm sorry, how was Camilla related to Senior, Henry Senior?
Camilla is the older sister of Henry Eyring, the scientist.
Gotcha. Okay.
So
so she was encouraging him, and he...
She was encouraging him as that he ought to get all the education he could.
And he's an Arizona boy.
He was an Arizona boy, yes. Ended up in Utah much later after having lived in other parts of the country, in Princeton particularly.
Right.
Where was
I? So your mother.
My mother.
So sometimes people joke that it's the woman that makes the leader, the man, and...
Well, that's sort of... My father used to, I think, rightly attribute some of what he was to the kind of woman he married. He, on more than one occasion, said to missionaries when he met a group, he said, "Take note of my wife. This is the kind of woman you should marry. She's never allowed me to be satisfied with mediocrity." She was, like him, self-educated because she read a lot, and she was a teacher. She was a teacher in the academy, the church-owned high school in Thatcher, Arizona. That's where she met him, and they got acquainted. After a very short courtship, they married, and he was expecting to be called up in the military at the time, and so they married probably a little sooner than they would have otherwise. But she was a hardworking small-town lady who had more smarts than money. They got along okay. The Depression was on when I was a boy. They managed all right, though it was a close call sometimes. But she always encouraged her husband, and he figured he could do whatever she would support him to do.
She's strong?
Strong, yes. Yes, and I was very close to her, partly because she did a lot with me as a child, and as a result of the polio that I had, massages and heat treatments and exercises and operations, recovering. We spent quite a bit of time in California, just she and me together. So that was very close to her, more than I think I would otherwise have been if I had not had polio.
So your high school years were in Utah?
Yes.
Which high school?
East High School.
East High School.
Actually, we came here, I was in junior high school, Roosevelt Junior High School, and then East High School, then the University of Utah for 2 years, then a mission to the Netherlands, and back to finish college, and then law school. University of Utah Law School. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania for graduate work in law. Got a job teaching first at the University of Montana, then called Montana State University. And then the University of Wisconsin, which was a step up professionally. And then in 1973, when the law school was organized at BYU, I was recruited to come and be one of the original faculty. And my wife persuaded me that this is where we ought to be for our family's sake, and because both her mother and my parents were aging, and it seemed like a good time and place to be. So I spent the time from 73 till I retired in 1995 as a faculty member at BYU.
Go Cougars.
Go. Actually, I'm always torn a little bit. I graduated from Utah
as, uh-huh.
and only taught at BYU.
That's twice the teams to love, right?
I do, yeah. I've root for Utah anytime except when they're playing BYU.
Me too. So what's it like having a father in the Quorum of the Twelve? I imagine he's gone all the time.
Well, he was not really gone any more than he had been as a businessman.
Meaning all the time?
All the time, most of the time, much of the time. He was gone on weekends, but he was there during the week most of the time. There were times when he went on a mission tour that he was gone for a week, couple of weeks, for example. But when he was home, he was home. He might be working, he might be reading, but he was accessible. And he didn't sleep much. He was diligent.
How many hours a week, how many hours a night do you think he slept?
Well, I was asleep part of the time, so I'm not sure. But he was, he probably slept 6 or 7 hours, sometimes more, sometimes less. But he was busy in the sense that he was occupied. His mind was occupied with his responsibilities. But as I say again, not to the neglect of family. I never felt neglected anyway.
Did you feel like you could talk to him about personal things, or was there a distance?
I think he was not very comfortable in debating religion with his children. It was too important to him. I think he felt much more comfortable talking religion to a stranger or to another church member than to his family. I tried out my heresies on my mother. She was the one who was open to that kind of subject discussion.
When you were a teenager?
Yes, when I was a teenager.
So you had a curious mind?
Thank you. Yes, I had a curious mind.
And your mom was there to...
And my mother was the right person to talk to. She couldn't answer the questions. She often admitted ignorance or incapacity. One of her phrases was, "I'll put it on the shelf." You know the idea of saying, if I have a question, I can't resolve it now, I'll not deny the proposition, but I'll wait and see. And she said later on I'd take it down. Sometimes it was answered. Other time it was no longer important. And still other times had to put it back on the shelf again.
Do you remember the types of questions you would have been asking her? Or is it?
Oh, my. Oh, you name them. I mean, polygamy, evolution, blacks in the priesthood. You can name any controversial subject, and could there really have been a flood that covered the whole earth?
You're hitting your mom with these in your teenage years, huh?
Yeah, I didn't always get an answer, but I appreciated the fact that she was open to any kind of heretical viewpoint that I might espouse.
Did it ever frustrate you that you didn't feel comfortable or weren't able to talk to your dad? Like, I imagine, from my perspective, I would think, well, Dad, he's there, he's close to the top, he's got the direct access, he's the man to ask, but you felt like you couldn't. Did you ever try?
Never that I can remember. That is it. It just seemed like she was the one to talk to. I don't know, maybe it was by designation, or maybe it was by nature. Some things in family dynamics I can't reconstruct. You know, when I was a kid, I was seeing things through a kid's eyes, and I no longer can see things the same way I saw them then.
But it wasn't like you tried to talk
to
your dad.
No, I was never rebuffed.
He shamed you.
I was never rebuffed, no. Yeah, it was not that he rejected my asking, and he would answer and try to give explanations about evolution. He would say, I don't know. However it was done, the Lord did it.
Really simple.
And when we're able to understand, he'll reveal more to us. So it was, his answers would be that way. Reflecting a willingness and yet not a comfort in arguing or debating with his children.
Or exploring?
We didn't explore together. He would give me his best answer and then I would go argue with my mother.
And she would argue with you?
She would, not in a harsh sense of the word, but she was open to talk about possibilities.
Good for her.
Good for her.
Those of us who have never had a close family member serve at a really high level in church leadership, even a father who's a bishop or stake president, can only imagine what the home might or might not be like. You could imagine everyone walking 5 inches off the ground with halos and fam home evening every week reliably, and scripture study reliably, and prayer reliably, and never an ill word spoken. Or you could imagine the most dysfunctional of all possible families where people can't talk, and there's meanness and cruelty and pressure to conform. And
it was a healthy, happy relationship. There was no kind of magical superiority. As I said, in every ward I've lived in, there are people as good as competent as any general authority. And my father was a good man. He was as good as anybody I know. And yet, he didn't walk off the ground. He did the best he could. Even when he became president of the church, he didn't think of himself as somebody special. He thought of himself more as a person whom the Lord chose to do a job. And he said in one of his sermons, he said that the Lord determined who would lead the church by governing life and death, and that there would be the succession. When it came to him, he accepted that it was his responsibility, because he said, it's the Lord's choice that I survived and that Harold B. Lee died. Maybe because it was something for him to do that Harold B. Lee couldn't do.
During the years he served as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve,
43 to 73,
that was a pretty, I imagine David O. McKay was prophet for most of that time.
That's
was
right.
President for most of the time. Are there any events or happenings that kind of stand out in your mind as being important for him, or that he was a really important part of, or tough or challenging before he became prophet? Any events or things stick out?
During that 30 yeah. years, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot. I'm sure there's a lot you could...
Well... No, I was pursuing my life while he was pursuing his, and there's not as much that I was not an insider. He didn't consult me on my opinions as to how the church should be run. Well, I would have been glad to give a little bit of advice had I been. As a matter of fact, I sometimes offered advice unsolicited. But I was going through school. Going on a mission, pursuing a profession, career, and while we had friendly family relations and affectionate. I was not involved in his ministry. I don't think I ever went with him to a state conference. If I did, I've forgotten. So I have less basis for answering than you probably assume.
Do you ever remember him telling stories about, President Benson or, Elder Benson is saying these things I wish you wouldn't say, or, President McKay is considering blacks and the priesthood thing, or like, would he ever tell stories or express dynamics?
When Dad was president, my mother said he never tells me anything because he can't remember which things are confidential and which things are not. He never says anything. There was a certain compartmentalization. There was a family and there was the church assignment. And he was not one who told tales about what had happened and who said what. And his journals are not as inclusive of detail as I would have wished as an historian. I'd love to have been present when some things were discussed by the first presidency. Greg Prince had the luxury of journals of President McKay that were much more detailed, much more inclusive of what you'd call tales.
Did you have a sense for the origins, the sources of his testimony and faith? Was it some big spiritual experience? Was it just feelings? Was it intellect? Other things?
He said at least once that he didn't ever remember not having a testimony. He didn't struggle with faith. He had faith, and it was his life. His father was faithful. His grandfather was faithful, and he was faithful. I think my mother had more questioning. She was more open, as I said, to discussion. He's not having the doubts himself, or having had the doubts himself, at least as far as he ever divulged to me. It was just part of his being.
So you have no sense that he ever had a crisis of faith, for example, or deep, dark moments?
No, I don't. He said things like, I wonder why the Lord would call me a country boy to be the president of his church. But that's actually a statement of faith that the Lord did call him, though he's maybe surprised at why the Lord called him, but he didn't doubt the nature of his call.
Let's talk about that. A lot of people... sometimes people, when they're referring to religions, like to use this Wizard of Oz kind of metaphor, that there's some wizard behind the curtain who isn't what he or she might claim to be, and he is propelling some image of something that he really isn't, but it's for the good of the people. And, sort of this noble lie sort of dynamic, and a skepticism as to the sincerity of the beliefs of the leaders. That's what some people do. And then in addition to that, there's an expectation that when you become called as a prophet, seer, and revelator, an apostle, and then as the prophet, that you would have some type of personal visitation with Jesus. And it's all people's speculation and their questions, but... what do you make of those expectations and speculations, and how do they fit with what you know of your dad's experience?
I can say that from long years of experience and exposure to my father, I haven't the slightest doubt about his faith. That is, that he believed he was called of God. So the thought that he was acting hypocritically just boggles my mind. Knowing the man, this was a man of consistency and credibility. As to supernatural experiences, he would talk sometimes about developments that he felt good about, felt were divinely encouraged or sponsored. An example might be the Indian Student Placement Program, over which he had some responsibilities. I think he felt that the Lord had given him the assignment to see to an improvement in the well-being of the Native Americans. And he invested huge amounts of energy in the development of that program. And he didn't ever attribute it, that I know, to some sort of voice from heaven, but he felt that it was what God wanted him to do. And that kind of feeling seems to me has to be the substitute for some grandiose vision. I don't know whether he had visions of the kind you mentioned. He didn't tell me about them. If they did, he, I think, would have characterized them as highly personal, individual blessedness.
Sure. About the Indian Placement Program, I once had a professor, not LDS and not at BYU. It was shocking to me. They referred to programs like that, and she was Native American. She called it cultural genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Because language, apparently people were taken from families, languages have died from the various tribes, as it's been hard to, and there was a lot of anger there. Have you ever heard comments like that, or thought about whether that's legitimate and or not? Or
I think I'm going to project now. My father's answer to that was that at the time when those programs were developed under church auspices, the conditions of literacy, health, so on the reservations were pitiable. The government had made so many promises that they did not keep, that the Native Americans were made to suffer greatly. And this was a step in the direction of giving them opportunities. Racial genocide would
cultural.
Cultural genocide would be a person's perception that it's clear that the motivation of the program was affirmative, was positive, to give. It wasn't so much to take away the Indian-ness as it was to give some of the opportunities in a white society that they were entitled to. And he not only would not object to the characterization that there was a problem, but he would say that he was doing his best to help solve the problem. Others didn't appreciate it, but should have.
Did you see a lot of good fruits come from that program?
My sister had an Indian girl living with her. I had no connection. We were living in Wisconsin and elsewhere during those times. I think that there may have been some good and some bad have come from it. I don't have a close enough connection with it. I know there was controversy, and I know that what the motives were from at least my father's side.
Were there quotes about, and this is some of the harder stuff, I think, I think I remember quotes in the 60s about, you know, Native American skins turning light or something to that effect by mixing with the whites. And
he did make a statement to that effect, and I don't believe that, but I don't know whether he was taking that literally or this was kind of a rhetorical statement, but he did say that intermarriage or rearing in the gospel culture would change the color of skin.
So he wasn't opposed to interracial marriage?
Yes, he was opposed to interracial marriage in the sense that he thought it added a complication to marriage, which is already a difficult relationship. But he would emphasize that there's no sin in it. It's not evil. It's simply like a rich girl marrying a poor boy. That's going to be one extra thing they have to worry about is money management, which probably produces nearly as many divorces as other causes. That clearly was his view. I remember overhearing a telephone conversation that where he was on at home and someone was talking to him about interracial marriage between a Native American youth and engagement, a fiancé.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was clearly nothing immoral or improper about it. It's just unwise unless they have a sufficient power, wisdom, self-control to overcome the antagonisms that might be aroused.
Right. When we read, race is obviously one of the central, one of the things I guess President Kimball's administration is most remembered by because of the 1978 revelation. But when you jump back 100 years in the church's history and you read what the prevailing thoughts were about race just in the United States in general, I mean, of course, slavery was allowed. But, even so among Brigham Young and others, a lot of comments that would be viewed as racially offensive today.
Mm-hmm.
Your father was raised in a time where those sentiments were still quite prevalent. And, the folklore...
Are we talking about Indians now? We're talking
blacks?
Just
white okay. superiority or racism okay. against blacks or whoever, any race really. Do you have a sense for your father's view on races just throughout his life in general? Did it change? Would he have been like Brigham Young in some ways? Progressive? Less progressive relative to us today?
I assume that he was less progressive than a lot of us today would think we are. But he was open to people without regard to color, as far as I was ever aware. When he was in Arizona as the state president, for example, there was a black school and they wanted to use a church chapel for a graduation ceremony in this little black school. And he authorized that. I mean, it would have been a simple thing to say, sorry, we don't have that available to you. But it's one feather on the scales of suggesting that he was not as biased as many of his contemporaries. To say that he had no biases would probably be to deny the obvious, that he was a person of his time. And it was not so much, I think, antipathy as simply an assumption that there was that there were different levels of society. There were those who were more blessed and those who were less blessed with intelligence, with economic opportunities, with education. And certainly members within the church who were black,
Dryce Gray or
Fleming. I forget his first name, Brother Fleming, who was employed at the Hotel Utah, was one my father knew well. And when they organized the Genesis group, I know that he attended picnic that they had in the summer. as opportunity allowed him to interact with American Indians, blacks, or Latinos, or any group that was identified by the community at large as somehow lesser, he resisted that. He said after the revelation on priesthood that he had had to fight with some things, that is his assumptions from his time and place, and that was part of his struggle to determine what it was that the Lord wanted done with respect to priesthood. So he was open to change. If he had biases, he would be the sort of person who would fight against them, who would consciously seek to make a change.
I'll ask one quick question about this, and then we'll turn a bit. There's the quotes that you might read, let's just say from the first edition of Mormon Doctrine, that talked about the less valiancy in the preexistence of some of the races, and that's why they were assigned a darker skin here. There's the Book of Mormon curse of the darker skin. Do you sense that he would have been typical in his belief or willingness to accept what I think now the church might call folklore? But do you think that was pretty much commonly believed, that the preexistence attachment of worthiness to skin color? Do you think he would have shared that just as a contemporary of...
I think he would have shared that as an assumption, largely unquestioned through most of the church's history. I mean, there weren't very many blacks in the church, and there was not a clamoring at the door to let us in, so that the motivation for change came out of some notions of fairness. And then the folklore about preexistence, so it fits that. It provides an answer to the fairness argument. And I think he was satisfied with that for a long time, as was I. I mean, that was part of what you were taught and assumed as you grew up. And then maybe you began to think about issues of fairness. And then those are times when I would write my father and say, don't you think we ought to be praying for a change? And he would write back saying, what is needed by the prophet is not complaint or criticism, but it is loyalty. If there's to be a change, the Lord will see that it happens, but it's not for us to demand change. So it was that kind of thing that was moving him, I think, to give traditional folklore answers to the question when he was a follower in the Quorum of the Twelve and not in charge. It was not for him to criticize either. But when he became president of the church, it was no longer somebody else's leadership responsibility. Now it's his responsibility to know, to find out what the Lord wants done with this. It was clearly a problem. Civil rights movement came into being almost in a finite period of time, and the pressures were on the church to change, and the leaders felt the pressure, but they resisted it, as did he, as far as his correspondence with me was concerned. But it came to be his burden to know what the Lord wanted. And I think at a time before I realized it, long before I realized it, he was seeking an answer to the question of whether it was as it must be or whether this was something that could change. And if so, if it could change, should it change? And if it should change, then it was for him to do it, rather than wait for somebody else to do it. That's one reason I think of him as his openness to change was a characteristic that made it feasible for him to overturn, if you will, the long-standing assumptions that I had, we had, that even though it didn't look right, somehow it was, had to be right.
There are a couple elements that I've read in Greg Prince's book, in maybe some of Michael Quinn's work. I'll just ask you a few of them that are listed as dynamics or events leading up to that decision.
Okay.
I believe Michael Quinn wrote about deliberations as early as the early 1960s about overturning the priesthood ban, and that Hubie Brown seemed to be advocating and even indicating in the press that the ban might be lifted as early as the mid to early 1960s.
Sure.
Yes. And your father would have been in the discussions about that.
Yes. And I was reading just the other day in Quinn's biography of J. Reuben Clark that President Clark had once proposed as kind of a junior priesthood, a second grade of priesthood for those that weren't entitled to the full range of priesthood. That sounds interesting and curious now, but that's simply another indication that it was a live topic probably ever since Professor Nelson's article about blacks and the priesthood, which was in the 40s.
Nelson, no. Who would that be?
I'm sorry, I forget his first name.
So that's a professor at
Minnesota.
Oh, okay. Wrote an article.
A Mormon.
LDS.
LDS sociologist who had been asked to make some inquiries about whether Cuba would be a place congenial to missionary work. And he learned in the process, or at least became conscious in the process of responding to that inquiry, that blacks could not hold the priesthood. And he wrote an article about that, and that sort of triggered awareness that hadn't really been at the public level before. And then you follow the trace through Lester Bush's important article that dealt with the history, and I think may have been very influential. That's partly based on inference. I don't have any knowledge, but I think that was important to show that there was another way to think of this restriction that didn't come out of scripture, that was historically based.
Yeah, sometimes we can have some amnesia and forget that in the early years of the church, blacks were ordained to the priesthood.
Yes.
And somehow, my guess is that it disappeared from the, I mean, it's probably not even in the general public consciousness today of church
really?
Members. Well, maybe more so, but my guess is in the 50s and 60s, people didn't remember Elijah Abel
right.
And have, you know, his name on the edges of their tongue.
I think that's probably true. And Elder Lewis,
right.
I didn't become aware of that until fairly long in my life. That's another major church, local church leader who was black and who had been, was in Nauvoo, as a visitor, and therefore was not some kind of strange phenomenon at the time.
There, I think I also remember Quinn's book talking about like 1968-ish when David O. McKay was sort of fading, Hubie Brown was kind of leading, and they actually took it to a vote, as I understand it. And it almost passed, but then something about Harold B. Lee coming in from out of town and
as to that, I don't recall.
You haven't heard that?
But I do remember a New York Times article quoting Hubie Brown as saying, we're considering making the change.
Right.
And I think he was probably criticized as talking out of school.
Right.
And no, I think there probably were discussions. How could there not be? Because it was a major political and social issue in the country at large.
Right.
But it was, I guess, just seen as untimely. Until they were ready to make the decision, they shouldn't be talking about making the decision in public. I think that's a question of organizational dynamics.
Sure. There's also this discussion about, because of your father's love for Native Americans and his participation, particularly in growing the church in Latin America and in Brazil, and the complexity with so many Brazilian saints being baptized and then later discovering and being given the priesthood, and then later discovering that they had African ancestry, that there, I've even heard people characterize it as that was going to become a can of worms that was going to potentially be embarrassing. Have you?
Well, I don't have any of this from my father. This is stuff I've gathered from talking to other people and reading what there is written about it. But I think that's probably true, though I recall asking my father about the Sao Paulo temple and wouldn't that create problems because of the uncertainty about ancestry, racial ancestry. And he said, I guess we'll just have to be more careful. You know, that's a dismissive answer, and yet I think if it doesn't portend a change, at least it seems to be recognizing the complexity of the issue and the possibility of change. That we're, to some extent, we're putting our own gloss on things after the fact without having good information, but I'd like to think that it was sort of a precursor to, that is the fact that the issue was thought about and talked about.
There's sort of this mythic expectation that the members of the Quorum of the Twelve, and especially the prophet, almost have like a bat phone in their communication with God, that when a revelation is to happen, the phone rings, you know, the prophet picks up the phone, he's told what the new change is going to be, hangs up the phone, calls the secretary, dictates it, and a new section of the Doctrine and Covenants is added. A very literalistic, concrete form of communication, I think, is sort of the folkloric expectation.
As far as I know, that's not an appropriate characterization.
Right, so I'm taking it extreme. But I guess let's talk about what led to the revelation.
Okay.
Whatever you want to talk about the revelation itself.
All right, I think it might be responsive also to the point you just made about what is the form of revelation.
Yeah.
One thing we know now that I didn't know at the time is that my father was talking about change in the restriction on priesthood long before I was, or long before the revelation, which made the whole thing public. That he was when he was giving me the traditional viewpoint in our correspondence, he was talking to other people more seriously about where does this come from and why are we doing this? And we know that he engaged the presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve in discussions of the issue for many months before the revelation. When I asked him about how it came to being, he said something like, I would sometimes lie awake at night thinking about all the complexities and the issues, the problems that it would present for the church to make the change. And that over time, as I contemplated these changes or matters, the difficulties, the conundrum, would seem to shrink into insignificance. And what I was left with was the impression of that I was to make the change. And Francis Gibbons, in his biography of my father, says that on March the 23rd of 78, Dad said to his counselors that he had come to the conclusion through his prayer and his study and his seeking to know the Lord's will that he was to make the change. And they said they would support him in that. But he didn't announce this at that time. From March 23rd until June, he continued these discussions with the Quorum of the Twelve. And engaged in continual visits to the temple where he would be alone and engage in prayer. And so then it came to the 1st of June, and he determined that he wanted and should have a definitive answer to whether, in fact, the impression that he had already received and had accepted was what really was wanted. And on that day, after the general meeting with all the general authorities, their first Thursday traditional meeting, he asked his apostles, the 12 who were there, there were two missing, whether they would stay with him and the presidency to seek a definitive answer from the Lord. And they agreed, engaged in a prayer circle, and in the course of that, they individually, group, had a confirmation, as they perceived it, of the decision that was placed before them. Sort of like Oliver Cowdery trying to translate the Book of Mormon. He said, you thought you just had to think about it, but you've got to study about it, pray about it, and then I'll give you the confirmation if what you want to do is the right thing to do. And it seems to me that's a pretty good pattern for the way I understand the proceedings went here, where there was a problem, a decision, and a seeking for confirmation of the resolution that they proposed, and that there hasn't ever been published a really detailed person-by-person account, and yet the ones I talked to talked about a feeling of unity that was unusual to them. One spoke about, it was for him, it was sort of like the rushing of wind. And others didn't characterize it except to say they knew what the implications were, that they were confirmed in their decision that this was the right thing to do. And so they waited a week, decided how it best should be announced, then called together all of the general authorities, told them what had happened and what the resolution was, the proposal was, and then it was announced to the world, and we rejoiced.
Were you proud of your dad?
Yeah, I was. I was pleased, first of all, with the substance of the revelation, the change that was taking place. It was very satisfying to me. But I was also pleased for my father, who I think deserved any kind of satisfaction that could be brought to bear as a result of that revelation. So I was pleased with that aspect of it too. And the notion that for those who believe in continuing revelation, that this was an instance of it in our own time. You don't have to look to Joseph or to Moses for instances of the Lord influencing human events by prophetic acts, pronouncements. So I had several reasons to be pleased.
Did you ever have a sense that this was a burden for him that he carried?
Before?
Yeah. And that maybe there was a sense of relief after?
Oh, I'm confident now that there was a great relief. I was not conscious of it at the time. No, he bore his... My mother was concerned. She said he seems to be distracted. It makes me concerned. She wondered whether there was some trouble with one of the general authorities or what it was that made him so concerned. And Arthur Haycock, Dad's secretary, responded to her question about what it was, saying, it's not anything that you have to fear. So he reassured her that it was not a bad thing that was happening. Arthur was very close to my father and sort of really at his elbow all the time. He deserved a lot of credit for taking good care of the leader.
Arthur Haycock.
Arthur Haycock, yeah.
Haycock?
Haycock.
Okay.
And President Hinckley, I think, deserves a special vote of approbation because of the way he led the church during the last 5 years of my father's life, when he was really not effective in initiating things. He could respond, but he was not able to initiate. And President Hinckley was really, because the other counselors were themselves aged, he carried the burden. And not only for those years of Dad's life when he was now a third counselor, but also President Benson, he carried the load there. And then again during his own presidency, a marvelous man.
Did you get to meet President Hinckley and get to know him a little bit?
I don't think I ever met President Hinckley. I don't think I ever met... I did meet President Benson because they lived just a half a block from where we did for a period of time. But I don't think I ever met President McKay. You'd think I was close enough.
I would think there'd be apostles going in and out of your house all the time.
No, not true.
No. So that's not what the home is necessarily like.
No, that was work, I guess. I think President Smith, Joseph Fielding Smith, I met him when I was married and he came to the reception. So
right. Do you have the sense that your father was an important part of the revelation happening?
I believe so.
So it wasn't just the bat phone rang and, oh, it's time to make the change.
Well,
it was at least in part his desire and efforts.
Oh, I think in great part. That's my perception. Maybe I'm influenced by what I wish were the case, but I really believe that part of his openness to change, his comfort with people of other races, his loving people, and his belief that he was called of God to do a work. I don't think that he knew in advance or what that work was to be, but I think he believed that he was there by design, and that when he was persuaded that a change needed to be made, then it was for him to make it.
Do you have the sense that some of his motivation was a love for all people and social justice and
yes.
Equality?
Yes, I believe that was a major factor.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.
as well.